in these words that I say, I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Gay. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart. Don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
And hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the California, the UC campus, UCI. Oh, boy, I start like this so often. Thank you. Anyway, we are here at KUCI, and we're on the web at KUCI.org, and I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and business of writing. And before we go on, let me say that the views that you hear on this show are those of my guest and me, and not the University of California Regents. Also, I have tickets to give away, Rod Piazza and the Mighty Flyers, Friday the 18th at the Coach House. One pair left. If you want those, email me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net. Whoever emails me first gets the tickets. Today my guest is Constance Hale. Constance grew up in Hawaii and returns there often in her writing. She left the islands to get a bachelor's degree from Princeton and a master's from the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. She's worked as a reporter and editor at the San Francisco Examiner, Wired, and Health. Her freelance work has appeared in Honolulu, Hot Wired, and The Atlantic Monthly. She has written two books on language, Sin and Syntax, and Wired Style, which have gotten her dubbed Marion the Librarian on a Harley or E.B. White on acid. Hi, Connie.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I love that bio. Who dubbed you Marion the Librarian on a Harley or E.B. White on acid?
It was funny. It was after my first book, Wired Style, came out, and it was reviewed in a language newsletter. It was called Language International. And it was, I thought, the most intelligent review that came out on Wired. But the thing that I loved about it the most was the sense of humor in that quote.
Yeah,
and
that's
of course
great.
It is, because Sin and Syntax, my other book, Sin and Syntax, as you can tell from the title, is I'm sort of Marion the Librarian, and that I'm teaching people about that thing, syntax, which is very librarian-like. But the whole reason, in my view, that you learn the rules of grammar and the codes, underlying codes of English, is so that you can break the rules and create a little bit of sin.
Well, that's great. I love this book. And you were on the show some time ago for such a little bit of time. I so wanted to bring you back. This book, I kind of read it in bits. And I pick up grammar books a lot because I think, you know, there's always something else to find out about grammar. But this one is just, the writing is so fine and literary that you read it for the writing as well. And the sense of humor at play makes learning anything about grammar you didn't know sort of fun.
Well, you know, that's the challenge about writing about grammar. You have to make it fun or people will fall asleep in their chairs.
How did you get into grammar? Were you always into grammar or did you see a need and you wanted to fill it or what?
Well, I guess it has kind of been a lifelong thing, but certainly not conscious for the first half of my life. I grew up, as you mentioned in your intro, in Hawaii. And I sometimes describe my experience growing up as a reverse immigrant experience, in that I grew up in a home in which my mother was a very strict grammarian and insisted on proper English at the dinner table and coached us on how to answer the phone properly. And then I would go to school, and I lived in a small rural town in the country in Hawaii, and everyone spoke what we call Pidgin English, which is actually the linguists call it Hawaiian Creole. So I went to school, and not even the teachers spoke standard English. So I had kind of this reverse experience where I was learning the quote-unquote correct English at home, and then I would go to school, all the rules would fly out the window, and we would speak this other language. And in time, I began to love Pidgin more than English. Because of its humor and its rhythm, and it's a very direct, full of life language, as many fringe languages are. I mean, I personally believe if you look at Black English or Spanglish or Southern idioms, a lot of idiomatic English, it's a lot more colorful and interesting than what we're taught in school. And so I think I was aware of that dichotomy for all the time growing up. And then when it came time for me to start trying to teach writing, you know, I was interested in myself and trying to figure out how to be a better writer, and then I started teaching high school English, and that's when a lot of these things came together, because first of all, I realized that to really help my kids write better, I needed to teach them certain things about how verbs work and how nouns work, and that it was useful to for them to know some syntax. But by the same token, I had a pretty rambunctious group of teenagers, and I had to keep everything entertaining. And so I think what had been this kind of lifelong interest in these two sides of English just kind of coalesced in my teaching method. And I wanted to make students, high school students, enraptured by English, and I wanted them to see that English could be fun and that writing could be... It wasn't all about just being hyper-correct. It's about really capturing slices of life.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest is Constance Hale, author of Sin and Syntax, published by Broadway Books. Some people seem to have blocks against learning grammar, or at least certain rules of grammar. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea why that is?
You know, it's funny. There's a quote that I just love by Joan Didion, who, of course, is a master of syntax. And she says, "Grammar is a piano I play by ear. Since I seem to have been absent from school the day the rules were taught, mm-hmm. all I know about grammar is its infinite power." And I think somehow we all have that sense that they taught the rules, but we weren't there that day.
Yeah.
And it is... I'm not really sure why that is. I think I have a little theory that part of it is American, because I've noticed that in other cultures there's less anxiety about grammar, and I think that's because in other countries people are surrounded by different languages, and you learn a lot about your own mother tongue by learning other languages. I think that's also when I really learned grammar myself, was when I started to learn French and then Spanish, and I also took Latin, so I think it was really... in studying other languages that I started to figure out what made our own language tick. So I think in America we don't really have that experience much of bilingualism, and then I think a lot of times grammar is taught in a very staid, unimaginative, boring way, and people tune out.
How do you make it interesting?
Well, I think, first of all, you don't have to have a lot of rules. There actually is some very basic rules. That's what, in my book, I try to do sort of avoid a lot of the school marms rules. I mean, a lot of really silly rules like don't split infinitives, which is crazy. You can split any infinitive that you want. things like don't end a sentence. There's just a lot of rules. Don't end a sentence in a preposition. That's wrong, too.
Where did that one come from?
Who knows? I mean, I think what really happened, in as much as I've done the research, what happened was we didn't used to have an English grammar. You know, in Chaucer's time and in Shakespeare's time, people didn't study grammar. There weren't even dictionaries. And it was really when people started making dictionaries, you know, in the 1700s and 1800s, that this kind of interest, there was a kind of scholarship that evolved. And English grammar was really kind of invented wholesale in the 1800s by a bunch of people who went back and looked at Latin. And they took the rules from Latin and applied it to English. Problem is, it's a different language. And so a lot of these rules, like in Latin, you couldn't split an infinitive because infinitive is one word.
Interesting.
In English, it's two words. There's a to and there's a verb. So an infinitive, for example, is to go.
Yes.
Well, there's nothing wrong with saying to boldly go. That's a split infinitive, but in English, it's fine. So a lot of these rules just evolved at a sort of run. Like people taking Latin and then just transferring the rules to English, and they don't, not all of them even work in English. They don't even describe English. And then sort of the flip side of it, what I try to do is say, okay, what really makes language tick? What are the kinds of words that really make language tick, and what are the function of these words? So, for example, it's really helpful to know what verbs are, because I believe that verbs are the essence of drama in writing. And one of the major differences between a novice writer and a very masterly writer will be their use of verbs.
Mm-hmm.
So a novice writer will depend on limp verbs like is and are or has, does, go, you know, just very common and what I call limp verbs. They don't have very much energy. They don't suggest very much dramatic action. A more confident and understanding writer will really spend time to use verbs like lunge or lurch or Hamlet, you know, shuffle off this mortal coil. you know, so an imaginative writer will really search for those verbs that are unusual and visual in their impact and energetic. Well, it helps very much if you want to become that more masterly, intelligent writer. It helps very much to understand what verbs are, because then you can go through your sentences and you can look for the verbs and say, am I really taking advantage of this opportunity? And I often tell writers, there should be one draft in the rewriting process. There should be one draft where the only thing you do is go through, look at the verb in every sentence.
What a good idea.
If you, and circle every, you know, circle every time you use is, circle every time you use has and does, these very unimaginative. Notice how often you're doing. There's nothing wrong with doing it in your first draft because, in fact, you should let things come out the way they come out. But the craft of rewriting is to go back and see your the patterns that you're engaged in and then play. Experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Try other verbs. And, you know, I believe very, very strongly that just that one little thing, just understanding that part of speech and how it functions in language, and then knowing how to go back and apply that little, it's not really a rule. It's just sort of, that's why I prefer the word code. You know, it's sort of the underlying codes of English. That's what that kind of word does. And this is the impact that it'll have if you can use that kind of word in your writing. So I think that's how you make it. That's how you teach grammar, you know, more kind of understanding how words function and how you can exploit them to your advantage.
Yes, interesting. What about using the thesaurus? You know, there are schools of thought that say, you know, if you do that, you're a weak writer, you're just leaning on crutches. And there are other schools of thought that say the thesaurus is there to be used. Find more interesting words.
I would like to get in a room with one of those people who says, don't use a thesaurus. and I'm going to take my biggest thesaurus and hit them over the head with it. You know, the truth is, I couldn't disagree with that more. I use a thesaurus all the time. I'm constantly opening up a dictionary. To have a great dictionary and a great thesaurus is, I mean, you can't even start writing without those two tools. And I should emphasize, you do need a good dictionary, and there's a difference between good dictionaries and bad dictionaries.
So what
and
do you recommend?
You also need a good thesaurus, and there's
what do you
a difference
recommend?
There. Well, most magazines, for example, use Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, the 10th edition.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people prefer the American Heritage Dictionary. What you want is a dictionary that has etymology that will explain to you a little bit of the history of words, because that's interesting. You learn a lot about words by understanding where they came from. And you also want usage notes. You want a dictionary that explains when... What example would be a good example? I just use, looked up something the other day. I was reading The New Yorker, and I noticed that there was a sentence that said, consists in. And I said, that's interesting. I always say consists of.
Right.
I know The New Yorker probably isn't wrong. so I went and I looked it up, and I learned, this was just the other day that I learned this, that you say consist of when it's material things, physical things. So, for example, a scrapbook consists of, old tickets, pictures, playbills, blah, blah. But you use consist in when you're talking about intangible things, ideas or something like that.
Mm.
So, you know, that's mm-hmm. what a good usage note will tell you, the difference between those two things. So those are the dictionaries. And then, of course, the Random House Unabridged Dictionary is a behemoth of a dictionary. So if you have a lot of money that you want to throw into a dictionary, put it there. And if you have even more money, the dictionary that I would love to have that I don't have yet is the Oxford English Dictionary, but that's, $3,000.
Oh, and what about thesaurus?
As far as thesauruses go, what I always tell people is, first of all, you want to get a good publisher, so you want to make sure that it's, a reputable publisher that's published this thesaurus. But the main difference in thesaurus is you do not want to have a dictionary-style thesaurus. That's a thesaurus that's organized by alphabetically, mm-hmm. and it's really a synonym finder. And the classic Roget's thesaurus is the one where you look up the word at the back of the book, and it gives you a bunch of numerical citations, mm-hmm. and then you go to those sections, and it's a lot more time-consuming to use it, but you get so many more ideas, and you just get that, every now and then, that thrill of the perfect word, finding exactly the word that you need, but you somehow couldn't come up with yourself. And I think that that's what writing is all about, just finding that perfect word that just sings, that name that hits the nail on the head, names the idea that you're the sort of vague, incipient idea that you're trying to give voice to, and you find a word that helps you do that. That's what writing is all about. So, I think the best, we all use thesauruses a lot, and then the more you do that, the better you become at. You start to be able to be your own thesaurus. So I, for example, when I'm writing, after I do my first draft and I'm taking hard copy and rereading and trying to make things better, almost every draft of a story that I have will, in the margin, have a list of words. I'll circle something on the page, say the word home, for example. I might have said she was, house. She was in her house, at the edge of such and such a park. And I'll circle house and I'll try to think, what, is there something else, is cottage better? Is bungalow better? Is Tudor mansion better?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I'll just cycle through as many words as I can myself, and it's just a little exercise. Have I really found the right word? And then sometimes the right one comes to me. Sometimes I have to go to the thesaurus.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I am talking with Constance Hale, author of Sin and Syntax, published by Broadway Books, and also author of Wired Style. I was looking through, I love quotation books, and I was looking through one today and came across this quote, and I'd like to know what you think about it. It's by Rita Mae Brown. She said, "Adjectives are the curse of America."
Well, almost every, I think I have a quote in my book from Mark Twain, and he was, I think he was advising a young writer. And he said, let me see if I can find, I hate to misquote Mark Twain, he's so quotable and he's so good, but I believe he said, when you catch an adjective, Mark Twain once wrote to a 12-year-old boy, kill it. No, I don't mean utterly, but kill most of them, then the rest will be valuable.
Yeah.
So that's what I think. I mm-hmm. think adjectives are tends to happen when we're trying to be colorful and descriptive is we start to load up on adjectives. And it's almost like loading up on carbohydrates or something. we just feel like we need to do more and more and more. And yet, after a certain point, more carbohydrates are worthless. What you really want to have is strong, powerful nouns. And then every now and then, an adjective to make that noun a little more colorful or to qualify that noun a little bit or make that noun a little bit more specific.
Mm-hmm.
What happens sometimes is often people put all their focus on adjectives and they get a pile up of adjectives and a very weak noun, and that's what we call purple prose.
Mm-hmm. And yet it seems that romance novels thrive on purple prose.
Well, they're definitely, so does marketing copy. Go pick up a women's clothing catalog.
Right.
I mean, there are certainly niches in which adjectives are, you know, adjectives rule, but we don't exactly call it great literature.
Right. So if you're into adjectives, find the genre.
Right.
Yeah. What about this quote? It's by George Eliot. She said, "Might, could, would. They are contemptible auxiliaries."
Hmm. It's kind of the same. I'm not really sure what she was referring to, but it's sort of the same idea in that I think what I always advise writers and what I try to do myself is to write in the simple tenses, to write in the present tense, which is the most dramatic tense you can use, or to write in the simple past tense. But to try to keep your tenses simple and to try to keep your verbs pared down to their essence. When you start clogging up sentences with things like "might have been vanquished," the sentences start to get a little harder to read. And I think, you know, again, those are tenses. We need every verb tense that exists in English. They serve a function. But what you want to do, try to control it a little bit so that your verbs are, I mean, let's face it, vanquish is stronger than might have been vanquished.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to just try to keep, as much as you can, keep distilling your language to the strongest essence.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. The second person. You talk a little bit about person, you know, whether you use first person, third person. What do you think about the second person? Why do we not use that very often? Why doesn't it work very often?
Well, part of it's probably convention. I think, face it, in journalism, what a journalist, you know, which is a lot of the prose that we read, let's take nonfiction first. You know,
okay.
So nonfiction, a lot of it's journalism. And I think it's pretty wise to realize that the strongest stance or point of view in journalism, some of the strongest journalism is when the journalist is kind of out of the picture and is observing other people in action. I mean, that's what reporting is about, seeing people clearly and not having the reporter there as a kind of filter or screen in between me, the reader, and the action. So third person makes a lot of sense in journalism. In novels and fiction writing, the omniscient narrator is the most, probably the most common form of voice. And it's great because you feel as a reader that you're like a fly on the wall. You're in the scene with the characters and you're there. The narrator isn't a screen in between you and the action. And that's the quality that an omniscient narrator gives you. Now, sometimes both in nonfiction and in fiction, we choose I, because sometimes the fiction, particularly if it's creative fiction or memoir or something like that, so a lot of times the presence of the author is really important to the story. In fact, it is the story, so I makes a lot of sense. Likewise, frequently, I think The Sun Also Rises. No, The Sun Also Rises is the third person, but you know, certainly there are great works of literature that are written in the first person. I think, isn't The Great Gatsby written in the first person?
I think so, and Presumed Innocent is one of the only novels I can, actually big, huge novels I can remember reading that I could actually not notice the first person present tense, actually.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, those are conventions, and there are good reasons that they exist. It just sort of depends on where the author is. If it's the author of the story or part of the story, or and kind of, you know, what the author stance vis-a-vis the reader is. Okay, well then what happens when you use you? Well, it's kind of an interesting voice because whenever you use you, you have the author addressing the reader. And the reader isn't the story. So it's just not really that useful frequently to use you. And then there are some authors who play around a little bit, and the example that comes to my mind is Jay McInerney in Bright Lights,
right.
Big City. And he wrote the whole thing in the second person. And when you first start reading it, it's kind of fun and racy and different. And around about page four, it starts to seem really contrived because it's not me in the bar snorting cocaine with these people. It's I'm reading about it. So it starts to feel a little false. Now, by the same token, so that's, I think it's just You know, what's the role of the author? What's the role of the reader? It's all, you know, what kind of relationship is the author trying to allow the reader to have with the characters? You know, where's the author, where's the reader, where are the characters? And that determines perspective or point of view. But a lot of times it's kind of interesting because I've been talking really about literature, about kind of nonfiction and fiction and thinking more about literature. But when you get into other kinds of writing, you know, like all that writing that goes on every day in offices and on the internet and in brochures and things like that, it's interesting because you start to have much more prominence. And in fact, there are people, it's called the Plain English Movement, who advocate a use of you because they think it makes writing more informal, more approachable, and it's certainly better than one, which is a very sort of academic example of the same thing. One must do such and such. And sometimes if you're writing, for example, in Wired Style, in my book Wired Style, which was really written, it had this whole, Wired Style had, you know, a lot of attitude. It's kind of a style manual, but it was also a manifesto from the publishers of Wired, and we kind of thought a lot, what's the right voice? What's the right voice for this book? And we thought, well, you know, we're kind of like, we're these digerati, as it were, you know, digerati telling people what to do, and it should be in the second person. It should be in the imperative voice. It should be like writing commandments, you know, do this way. When you write email, do not use a hyphen. So that's another time when you want to use the second person, that you, is when you're basically bossing people around.
I'll have to remember that.
Can I just mention something
That's
interesting along these lines? I do a lot of editing, and I edit books for one of the major academic publishers. And so many of the authors whose books I'm editing are academics. They're experts in their field, but they're not writing literature. And I find it's really interesting these people aren't really novice writers in that they're writing, publishing all the time in academic journals, but I find that people often have a really hard time settling into their right voice. And so I notice a lot of times in a book, I'll notice that an author sometimes the author will be using we, sometimes the author will be using I, sometimes the author will be using you. And a lot of times when I'm editing a book, a very early conversation that I have with the author is to say, you know, what stance do you want to have to your reader? Do you want to basically establish yourself as an authority and an expert on a subject, and you are telling people what to do? Or do you want to have a voice, like in which case you would use you and kind of an imperative voice? Or do you want to say we, and basically that's more inclusive, so you're talking to the reader as though you're part of the same group as the reader? Or do you want to use I? Do you want to relate your personal experience? And it's just, I find frequently that people don't think about that when they're writing a draft. They don't think about, what relationship do I want to have to my material? What relationship do I want to have to my reader? And then that relationship is telegraphed through the pronouns that you use.
Oh, I have some questions regarding that. I have to make some notes here. As soon as we come back, I'm going to ask you.
Okay.
Don't go away. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more Constance Hale, Sin and Syntax. Stay with us.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. One bit in a day, let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine, broadcasting from UCI, from the campus, right here. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today we're here with Constance Hale, author of Sin and Syntax. Before we go on, I do have tickets for you, Rod Piazza and the Mighty Flyers at the Coach House tomorrow night. One pair is left. Let me know if you want them. Email writersonwriting@earthlink.net, and they're yours. Constance, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, great. Okay, I didn't hear you first. Before we took the break, you were talking about whether an author uses we or you or I. Is one better than another, or does it really all depend on context and the relationship with the reader?
I don't think any of them is better. The only one I think is horrible is one. You know, in other languages, in England they use one more, and in French they use it all the time. One is really like, you, instead of saying let's go, you would say one goes in French. On y va is how you say let's go. You use one instead. So in some languages it's much more natural, but it just doesn't seem natural to us. So with that exception, I think it just really depends on the tone you're trying to set and what's most natural. I think sometimes you have to, I find it takes a couple drafts sometimes for me to figure out some of these things.
Yeah, I find that with a column I write, I often use we when I'm starting, and my husband will read it and say, you know, why are you using we? You're bringing the reader too much into it. Mm-hmm. And I always think that's sort of an interesting perception, mm-hmm. as opposed to when I use you, he's like, yeah, now that feels comfortable.
Right. Well, I think it depends on also where is your focus. For example, frequently I see writers writing profiles of other people. And a common mistake, or when I give writing assignments, a common mistake, people will start out writing a passage saying, you know, I once met so-and-so, you know, I first met so-and-so in 1984, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the article is about so-and-so. It's not about I.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to bring an immediate, sharp focus to your subject is to focus on that subject. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the author can really get in between the reader and the subject. So I think none is better than the other, but I think you need to think about it very carefully and consider what tone you want to establish and who the subject of the piece really is.
Yeah. You talked a little bit before, I mentioned it anyway, about voice, you mm-hmm. know, just really settling into voice.
Mm-hmm.
What about finding your voice? Do you have any thoughts on that? It seems to be one of the hardest thing new writers do or try to do, is really settling into voice, and then they have to deal with the question, is it my voice for all pieces, or is
right.
it just the voice for this piece, and how do I find that?
Right. Well, voice is an interesting thing. For example, I think I have several voices when I write. Certainly sometimes I write in a kind of cheeky, sassy tone, that particularly when I'm writing about grammar, and I do that very intentionally because I don't want to bore people, and I don't want to sound too formal, and I really want to make it fun, and I signal that through the voice.
And syntax, it's real kind of sassy and
yeah,
fun.
Yeah, that's certainly the voice there. In other times, for example, I write a lot of memoir and personal essays, and in those, my voice is quite different. It's you hate to describe yourself as lyrical, but it's more of a lyrical voice. It's a kind of literary, poetic, lyrical voice when I write those sorts of pieces. On the other hand, I recently wrote a piece about taking my mom to Provence, and I thought when I started the piece that it was going to be funny, because my mom and I stayed in this place. It's called a mas, an old farmhouse that had been restored, and I thought we had found the Provence version of the Bates Motel. I mean, I somehow managed to find probably the most bizarre place to stay in Provence, all because I wanted to avoid Americans, and I avoided not only Americans, French. Nobody stayed at this place but losers like my mom and I. And so, you know, I thought it was going to be this funny, kind of lighthearted piece, and in fact, the place wasn't that bad. It was definitely bizarre, and it wasn't what we expected, but we ended up having a wonderful time there. And the proprietors were these complete characters. The guy was like a Camargue cowboy, I call him. I mean, he was like a French version of the Marlboro Man, you know. So it was really a great experience, and I thought it was going to be written in that voice that I'm using to describe it, you know, the kind of funny, not what you expect. And then as I started writing the piece, all of a sudden what I thought was going to be a 2,000 piece about taking my mom to Provence was stretching out, and it ended up being a 5,000-word piece, and it was about my relationship with my mother. And I started out thinking I was going to write this one piece, and it was going to be this funny kind of, not Thelma and Louise, because we weren't girlfriends. We were, you know, a mom and daughter duo, you know, mom and Connie hit Provence. And and I ended up writing this very different piece and realizing that the reason we went to Provence was because my mom had lived there 45 years ago, and she'd never been back, and I learned a lot about my mother by taking her there. And I incorporated, partly because I had an editor who wanted me to, I incorporated a lot of emotional details about my mother's life, and all of a sudden, the whole tenor of the piece changed. Although I have to say, I tried to keep some of the humor in there, so it's kind of an interesting piece where it was very hard to kind of have both of those voices in the piece at the same time. But I did, because our experience wasn't one-dimensional. It was kind of, on one hand, it was lighthearted and funny and really fun. On the other hand, there was some kind of deep stuff going on under the surface, and I needed a different voice to write about that stuff. Mm.
Now, who did you do that for?
Actually, it's for Traveler's Tales. Mm-hmm. Which is they publish travel writing books.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, the editor sort of asked me to write it, so we'll see whether or not he likes what I came up with.
So when you do your narrative nonfiction, are you gearing it or slanting it for the publication, or do you do it and just see sort of how it ends up, that it ends up how it's going to end up?
Well, that's a tough question. I mean, I wish I was a better marketer. I mean, you know, most writers, I think, have a hard time. You know, you really want to write the piece that's in you and the piece that you want to write. You don't want to have to shape it for a publication. But I do kind of make my living doing this. So I try as much as I can to always write things on assignment. So in other words, I've already hooked an editor and we've agreed what a piece should be. And I start the writing knowing that it's for a particular publication and they have a particular interest and there's a certain length that I'm supposed to write. This piece for Traveler's Tales was kind of neat because I was just kind of invited to do it. They didn't guarantee me they were going to publish it, and it was nice to get an invitation to just write the story that was in me and do it the way I wanted to. But then I did give it to the editor, and he wanted more of a lot of things, and so I did rewrite it quite significantly. But, you know, that sort of leads me to something else, which is kind of part of my process. When I'm working on a big story, something that I think is going to be big, and it might be, for example, I did a long piece for Health Magazine about taking care of my father in the last year of his life when he had a really bad neurological disorder. Well, when I was going through that experience with my dad, it was so hard and it was so painful that I had to keep a journal. I mean, there was just, I had to. And I also felt, because he was terminally ill, I wanted to write everything down because I knew I wouldn't remember everything because of the emotional stress. And I wanted to record everything about his last year. So I kept this journal, and the journal was just kind of amazing. It really helped me get through it. And I was just writing my heart out in there. It was nothing about publication. I was just recording incidents, dialogue, little conversations with my dad, sometimes just going and writing in my journal at the end of a long, grueling day and pouring my heart out. Well, a year later, I wrote this piece, and I turned to the journal. And so at that point, I knew that I was going to be writing a 3,000 to 5,000 word piece for Health Magazine, and they were doing a whole package on caregiving, and I knew it was going to be part the emotional center of this package. And you know, I had a lot of parameters from them, and then I went and I took the journal and I just dove in and scooped out things that I had written in the moment, and I think it really gave the piece a kind of immediacy that I wouldn't have been able to achieve if I had just been writing in hindsight, you know, a year or two later.
Mm-hmm.
And it also was really, there were places where it was just very poetic, and I don't know, sometimes you can't just kind of be poetic on demand, you know, and so I was able to, I had this resource of all this stuff, and I find that that's really valuable for me, and I'm preparing to write a long nonfiction book now, and I'm also keeping a journal because there are moments when I'm doing the research where it's actually a chronicle of a line of men in my father's family. So there are moments when I see a metaphor, or I have an experience, or I feel something, and I just pull out the journal and I write it. And I don't know whether that stuff will make it into the book eventually, but it's a way for me to kind of do both things simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. I like that. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with Constance Hales, author of Sin and Syntax, published by Broadway Books. Who do you read for their use of language?
Oh, gosh. Everybody I can. I do read The New Yorker, and I love Adam Gopnik. And he's interesting because he's a person who will frequently write about syntax in an essay. You know, he'll talk about the use of a verb or a pronoun or something. Joan Didion does the same thing. She sometimes really looks at the way sentences are structured. She actually kind of, I can remember essays of hers in which she writes about, in fact, she wrote an essay called Why I Write, which is a meditation on the pronoun I. And so those are two people in sort of narrative nonfiction that I really admire. I try to read a lot of poetry, actually, because I think that reading poetry really sensitizes you to the language and to the power of words in a way that, say, journalism never does. So I have my favorite poets, and I kind of collect poems too. When I read a poem that I really love, I save it. I have a little book of all my favorite poetry.
Who do you like?
I really love W.S. Merwin, mm-hmm. Who writes in a very lean, spare style, but his poetry is really powerful and metaphoric and lyrical at the same time. And I have some friends. I have a friend who's a poet. She's actually, I taught her, she was in that high school English class that I taught, you know, many years ago. And she grew up and became a poet and had her name is Tessa Rumsey, and her first book of poetry won the University of Georgia Prize and published. And so I read her, I ask her to send me stuff and read it. I do try to read poetry. And then probably in fiction, I really love short stories. So the collection of short stories I have on my desk right now is Maeve Brennan. But I've read the classics. I mean, I it's hard to say. I go through periods,
yes.
You know, where I have one favorite writer or another favorite writer, and then somebody will come along and just blow me away, and I read everything by that person.
Hmm. I'd love to hear some of your stuff. Every so often I come across a piece of yours, like the one in the Atlantic Monthly recently,
mm-hmm.
On the hula.
Right.
And, you know, you pop up here and there, and, oh, there she is. would you read to us?
Sure. Actually, what I thought I might read, because I knew we were going to be talking about process, and I knew that I might mention this thing about keeping journals, I thought I might read the ending to that piece about my father,
yeah.
Which comes directly out of my journal. I mean, actually, the journal entry was longer than this, so I edited it down, but I think that if you keep in mind that I wrote this article about a year, after my father had died, and, you know, in some cases, I was writing about incidents that had happened a year and a half before. This is the very ending, and just to fill in, my father was a career Army officer. He went to West Point and fought in Vietnam, and then retired from the Army and worked in defense. And so we knew that he was going to be buried at Arlington Cemetery, and I don't know if I could have written this passage. I wrote this soon after his funeral, and I'm going to read you the very end of the piece. We have planned a funeral with full military honors at Fort Myer and Arlington National Cemetery, hundreds of people, a marching band, a horse-drawn caisson, and one riderless horse, but the weather does not cooperate. As we sleep, or try to, on the eve of the funeral, snow starts to settle around us. By morning, a blizzard is whirling through the fields of Great Falls, the Weather Channel announcing a 100-year storm. Your dad would say, go on as planned, Dottie says, that's my stepmother, and go on we do. Our meager caravan, three black limousines, dad's green truck, a few rental cars, wends its way under a low gray sky. Trees are bare. Lone figures are muffled. It's as though the whole world is in mourning. At the cemetery, Dad's most faithful friends huddle with his little clan before the flag-draped coffin. Birds of paradise, palm fronds, and pink torch ginger, flown in from Hawaii, struggle to stand in the wind. A lone bugler plays taps. Then, the sound of gunmetal as the soldiers in the snow change formation and fire the three-gun volley. Back in the limo, heading home, I sit at the window looking out at a world that is white, white, white. The ground, so still, is white. The sky, so low, is white. The tree limbs, so bare, are white. The road, so dangerous, is white. The air, so thick, is white. The snow, the white, is everywhere, swaddling us tight like a curious, furious blanket. So close, omnipresent. Dad is everywhere. Dad is the snow, not letting us go.
That's gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous.
Now, that's edited from my journal, but that's what I was talking about. I mean, that is not sassy and cheeky.
No, that's quite the opposite
from
Sin and Syntax.
That's a very different voice from Sin and Syntax. But I hope that people can hear that I worked really hard on rhythm, things like rhythm and the music of the words.
Sure.
And, the voice, you know, I think the voice just came out naturally in my journal, but then the rewriting process was trying to work the rhythm so it worked just right and to really create the feeling of that day. And a lot of the details I wouldn't have had if I hadn't written them down right away.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, I noticed from the start present tense, which was, mm-hmm. you know, just so perfect. It, mm-hmm. it couldn't have been anything else.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about in longer works, though, present tense? Do you think that's workable?
Yes, I do. Actually, I think that once you settle into something, readers kind of adjust and they're there with you on the page.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really have a problem with the present tense in longer works, and I don't have a problem using the present tense when I'm clearly writing about something that was in the past.
Yeah.
I think so long as you stay in the present tense, you have to stay there. You can't flip back and forth between the present tense and other tenses. Or, I mean, I suppose you can if you're really, really, really good and you're experimenting and doing something kind of avant-garde, but most of us aren't that. most of us aren't there yet. I love the present tense.
And talk a little about simile and metaphor too, because what you did in that piece you read was just so nice and very kind of simple and appropriate. Mm-hmm. And it seems that writers kind of get stuck when they start throwing similes and metaphors into their work, if, mm-hmm. especially if they're not appropriate or they're,
right.
you know, other than even cliched ones.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, kind of inventing your own can be kind of a chore.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, first of all, similes and metaphor is wonderful. You know, I mean, metaphor just elevates a piece. It makes it poetic. Sometimes you just can't find a word to express something, but you can find a metaphor. So, you know, it's just one of the most wonderful tools that we have as writers. But the first thing is you can't overdo it. You have to really, simplicity is key. And so you have to pick a metaphor and stick with it. It's interesting, I was just editing, I'm teaching a class right now, a little writing class, and I was just editing a piece, and I had just given a very simple assignment for someone to go sit somewhere and describe the scene using nouns. That was the assignment. And, you know, it's funny, one piece that I came upon was describing a room, and at first the room was one big giant scrapbook, and then the room was a shrine, and then the room was an all-purpose room for her family. And in one paragraph, she had three different metaphors. And so the piece became really confused, and it's a matter of choosing one and sticking with that one, and what's the one, what is really the most appropriate. And then all your descriptions need to correspond. So, for example, if you choose the metaphor of a sacred place, then you need to describe the things in that sacred place with a kind of sacredness or a kind of reverence. If it's a scrapbook, you know, you're gonna describe things in a very different way. So you need to be consistent. You have to be mindful of what your metaphor is and then be consistent. And then that's assuming that the metaphor is good. And as you mentioned, sometimes people either use cliches or they'll come up with a metaphor that's just not apt. So the funniest example that comes to my mind is David Mamet was talking about metaphor and bad screenplays, and he talks about descriptions her eyes were like olives in a plate of milk. And, you know, it's like, nice try, no cigar. You just kind of go, yuck. So that's an example of someone who is trying to be creative, you know, points for being creative and not using a cliche, but it doesn't work as a metaphor.
Yeah, interesting. How many drafts do you tend to go through with your work?
Good question. A lot. And the magic number for me is 7. And, of course, you know, with a computer, it's kind of hard to say how many drafts you go through because you go in and change minor things. But when I'm writing something major, a book or a long magazine article, I find that it's around draft number 7 that I really get my voice. And from 7 onward, the piece has gelled, and I'm just kind of, polishing. But usually for me, the first couple of drafts, and this doesn't matter whether it's a book or whether it's an article, the first couple of drafts, I'm usually trying to get the large chunks in the right places and figure out what goes in and what comes out. So my first few drafts, I'm moving things around in large chunks, and I'm trying to figure out what the narrative structure is. And then I spend a few drafts getting really depressed. It's not working, and the language sucks, and I'm a terrible writer, and why did I ever take this assignment? I have drafts, like, you know, I'm kind of excited. Drafts 1, 2, and 3, I'm excited, and I'm not putting too much pressure on myself for it to be really good. I'm just trying to, it's kind of like an outline, but a really fleshy outline, and then around drafts 3, 4, and 5, I get really, really depressed, because I think I'm a really terrible writer, and this is never going to be good. What was I thinking? Boy, was I wrong. And then around 6, I start to get a feel for the thing, and I start to get a feel of what the right voice is. And once I nail the voice, the writing starts to become really fun, because by that time I've worked out the structural problems, and I've got the stuff in there that I want to have be in there. And once I get to just start work, you know, I settle into my voice, then I really enjoy. And the drafts beyond that don't count, because they're just fun.
So the first draft, you'll get it down, and then the second draft, will you do what you suggested, which is go through and check out the verbs, maybe check
out... No, I'm not doing that yet. I'm not doing that until, like, draft 3 or 4,
uh-huh.
Or 5, maybe. I'm looking at, in the first few drafts, I'm looking at the narrative structure, you know, what's supposed to be at the beginning of this story, what's supposed to be at the end of this story, oops, I've got a hole right here, oh my God, I didn't do this reporting, or... And then I usually around draft 3, the piece is usually twice as long as it's supposed to be. Then I have to cut like mad.
And how do you decide what to cut? Just what doesn't work, what doesn't belong?
That's where I have to really wrestle with, what is this story really about? Is it so, for example, to use that piece about Provence that I was talking about earlier, about taking my mother to Provence,
yes.
When it becomes clear to me that the story is really about this mother-daughter journey, it doesn't really matter whether or not I say what restaurant we ate in, for example. It
right.
doesn't really, I don't really have to mention every single place we literally went in Provence, because that's not really what the piece is about. Piece is really about my mom and me, and so I need to focus on the places that mom and I went where it was really an important experience. It said something about our relationship. So I start to cut out the stuff that might be interesting or it might be factual, like but we went there next, but then we went to Arles. I have to write about Arles. Well, not if it wasn't meaningful. I don't. So it's kind of, once you get what the story is really about, then you cut anything that isn't really tightly tied to your central theme.
Yes. Oh, I wish we had more time. I'm going to say I want you to come back again.
No problem.
Thanks so much. I really have fun talking to you.
I enjoy it, too, and thank you for letting me read.
Oh, you're welcome. We'll talk soon.
Great. Thank you.
That was Constance Hale, author of Sin and Syntax by Broadway Books, and you'll see her here and there in wonderful magazines like the Atlantic Monthly and various magazines. Look for her name, Constance Hale. If you have comments or questions or would like to know about future guests and events in the area, visit my website at writersonwriting.com, and there you can sign up to be on the mailing list. I would like to end with a quote by Tony Cade Bambara, who said, "Words set things in motion. I've seen them doing it. Words set up atmospheres, electrical fields, charges." You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Thank you for listening, and please, stay safe.